Hello, welcome, welcome to Paradigm Shifters. I'm Veronica Entwistle, and as you know, I love to meet up with people who are making a difference on the planet. Tonight's guest, John Perkis, is no different. Well, he is unique. He's written a book called The Power of Letting Go. And you might say, oh, that's an old familiar subject. But John's interesting. He's got a position as a recruiter for chief executives and CFOs. He spent a number of vacations or times going into India and studying various meditation techniques. And his book is amazingly simplistic to read. And when you read it, it's quite surprising how it'll kind of drop you out of attachment to perhaps an ego or an emotional thing or something to do with your story from your growing up years. It just seems to drop me out of a number of holding patterns. I may be unconscious about it. It's probably true for you too. Then it takes you on a much deeper tour into consciousness, true consciousness. Let's explore with John Perkis what that really means.
Yeah. Well, I tend to go by experience. So in my case, what happened was that I learned mindfulness pretty much by accident.
Okay.
And that kind of gave me a little taste, because I think some people really wrestle with mindfulness. In my case, I experience pure consciousness occasionally, you know, when there's a gap in the thoughts. But what really did it was in 2002, I learned transcendental meditation. Mm. And then it was, I mean, a lot of people say that was like falling into a pool of pure consciousness. So, and I've been doing that ever since. Yeah. So that was my introduction to pure consciousness. So basically, you're conscious, but there aren't any thoughts, which is odd, because a lot of people, they have so many thoughts all day that they end up believing that they are their thoughts, which is not true.
Well, it's very difficult, isn't it, to get into a centering place that is so effective that you can observe your thoughts and take charge of having them or not having them. That's a big step, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a big step. And I recruit chief executives and CFOs and all that kind of thing. I meet lots of people in business who say they've never experienced pure consciousness. But if you say, well, okay, have you ever stood on top of a mountain and your mind shut up for a few seconds, or, you know, in front of such a beautiful landscape that your mind suddenly went silent? And in some cases they say yes, or, you know, just after you wake up before your mind reboots, you know, when you're just kind of there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people have experienced it, but it's often for very short periods.
What drove you to want to experience it? You said you went in to mindfulness by accident.
Yeah, well, what happened was...
Are there such things as accidents, John?
Well, not really, no. I don't think so, no. It's all part of the divine plan, I'm sure. No, in my case, I mean, a lot of people have experienced this. So I had a very successful academic and professional start in life. And then at 26, as you would have read in the book, at 26, I had clinical depression that nearly killed me. And I came to the realization that being clever and hardworking was not enough to be happy and successful, you know, because a lot of us have been brought up to believe that if you're clever and hardworking, you're going to have a great life. And I discovered quite quickly that that wasn't true, mm-hmm. at least for me. Mm-hmm. And that's when the search began. And then it wasn't until 9 years later that I learned mindfulness pretty much. In fact, I was reading a novel. You might know him, actually, a chap called Ken Roberts on the West Coast.
No, I don't know him, actually, but
he was based
I do
in,
like writing. Huh?
Yeah, well, he's an interesting guy. He was an English teacher. And I was living in Paris, and I was reading this, following this course about how to trade futures and options, which he'd written. And then halfway through, he said, oh, the most important thing is the mind. He'd written this novel. So I read the novel, and I learned the novel was basically teaching you how to keep returning to the present moment. And this was the year before The Power of Now was written. So I had no clue what I was doing, but I just noticed that it worked. So I started doing what the protagonist in the novel was doing. And suddenly my life started changing. And then the following year, The Power of Now came out. And I thought, oh, that's what this is.
I noticed reading.
And then the mindfulness wave took off, you know.
That's great. I noticed reading your book that, and I do a lot of energy, and I think you know that sort of thing, and I'm an intuitive.
Yes, yes.
And I noticed reading your book and going through exercises, how interesting it was, how just letting go, whether it's, and I made lists of the ways of letting go, it really boots up your own personal power in a very interesting way, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's a paradox. I mean, the principle is very, very simple. Mm-hmm. I have a lot of intellectual friends, and the way I try to explain it to them is say, well, okay, so you've got this brain, which you spent all this time training up and educating, fine. But the way I see it is my brain is part of something infinitely bigger and more intelligent. So I have a choice. I can either rely on this brain, which has limited information and processing power, or I can tune into something that's infinitely bigger and more intelligent. It strikes me the latter is a better plan. And it happens when we let go and relax and allow that infinite intelligence to run life instead of trying to figure things out the whole time.
So you think, do you believe that life is flowing to us and through us always with our personal journey in mind, sort of thing?
Well, the way I see it is, I mean, if you look out of the window, and you know, unless you live in I'm sure you don't live in a concrete jungle, but unless you live in a concrete jungle, if you look out the window, you can see sort of nature working flawlessly, right? Mm-hmm. and of course, we human beings intervene and mess the whole thing up now and then, which we've just done yet again recently, right?
And the worst part about that is we do it unwittingly.
Well, but it's kind of willful ignorance, right? Yeah. Oh, this terrible thing happened. Well, yeah, but if you piece it together, you know, it either came out of a lab or it was because someone ate a bat or someone did something, you know, but it was a human who did it, right?
Right.
So the way I see it is, yeah, you could call it, you know, they talk about that which is beyond name and form. You probably saw in the book, I found 33 names for that which is beyond name and form. So you could call it existence or God or life or whatever you want to call it. But essentially, there's this super intelligent flow going on. And we're part of it. And we have, I suppose, ego is when we detach ourselves from it. And that's what makes life very difficult.
Mm-hmm. And so when you're talking about letting go, it's essentially unhooking from those various things that keep us, spinning around in the stream.
Yeah. But it's very specific. I mean, I wrestled with this for a long time. I was brought up as a Christian, and I took a close look at Buddhism, Sufism, Kabbalah, and then eventually met up with the guru that I mentioned earlier, who's from the Hindu tradition. This is a really big puzzle for me, and it took me several years to figure it out, is people talk about ego and all the rest of it. And then what he says is the ego is made up of incompletions, and these incompletions are pain patterns. And as you probably read in the book, that's the focus of chapter 3.
Mm-hmm. I did.
Of the power of letting go. So, for example, if you think about, I'm sure this is true for just about everybody listening, is I meet a lot of people through my work and my social life, and everybody's blocked in some way. So if you look at health, relationships, work, money, everybody's blocked in at least one of those areas. I mean, I've met billionaires who are blocked in usually health or relationships. And then there are other very spiritual people who have blissful relationships and are always broke. So everyone's got their pattern. But what is really interesting is that you can identify those patterns and remove them. And what you're basically doing is dismantling your ego. Mm-hmm. And that's the connection that very few people make. You know, and there are people who spend their time trying to destroy their ego. But it doesn't really work. In fact, it doesn't really work very well. It's just the ego naturally kind of collapses as you remove all of that. Basically, it's pain which is stored in your system.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. So what do you think humans are? What do you think we're here for?
Oh, well, I mean,
that's a simple question, isn't it, John?
What Swamiji would say, he would, you know, because we can all debate, he basically says the purpose of life is to raise your level of consciousness.
Okay.
And as far as I can see, that's true. So if I look back over my life, even before I met him, I could see what was happening is I would get stuck and I felt as though I'd run into a brick wall. And then I realized, oh, no, I need to go up a level. And so it's like going up higher levels of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And I've just had another jump in June. So it just feels like, okay, I can go along for a while and everything's blissful, but then you suddenly run into a brick wall, and after a while you kind of realize, oh no, I need to go up a level, otherwise I'm not going to go forwards.
Well, you said you just had another jump in June. I go, oh, what did that feel like? How do you measure that?
Well, I found it initially felt terribly frustrating, like, you know, people not paying me for work that I've done, or relationships not working out, or this kind of thing. And then the way I look at it is if something is, if everything is, this is my personal viewpoint, is if nothing is working in my life, it means there's something very simple that I'm not doing right. If I can just find out that one thing and change it, then my whole life will change.
Well, do you think you have a purpose? Do you think you have a divine flow that wants to express in this, on its way to a higher consciousness? Do you think each of us has that, is the question, really?
My impression, yes. I mean, I can see the rising level of consciousness happening. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I was running a workshop a few years ago, and we used to run these workshops about talents and values and purpose and things. And someone in the audience says, what's your purpose? And I hadn't really thought about it. And I just said, to help change the world. It just kind of came out of my mouth. And then I realized that's probably about right. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's clear. So I'm always interested in anything that helps change the world in a positive way. But I suppose I've realized that you can only do that if you're constantly working on yourself. Otherwise, you end up just trying to fix people, which it doesn't work.
And how would you change the world? Just to be hypothetical, not hypothetical. No, you probably know what it is. Go ahead.
No. I think one of the most useful, I think this is how I see it, is particularly in the West. I work with Americans a lot, and I've worked for several American companies as well as Europe. I find
that's a lot of hard work these days, isn't it?
Yeah. But what is interesting about the West, let's say Europe and I've never been to Australia, but let's say Europe and the US in particular, is we have this cultural emphasis on fixing things outside of ourselves. So we see a problem, we try and fix it. Mm-hmm. You know, so now we're trying to cook up a vaccine for the virus, mm-hmm. which we probably caused. And then, you know, and then there's a problem with global warming. So we try and we'll invent something to try and, deflect the sun's rays or, you know, hoover up the carbon or something. So basically we keep looking outwards and trying to fix the outside world, whereas the Eastern traditions tell us that we need to turn inwards and work on ourselves. And so to answer your question, the way I see it is I need to work on myself. And what I notice is actually people come to me who want to work on themselves. Mm-hmm. And that's how the world changes. Mm-hmm. So I did a webinar last week for a friend who's in Beirut. And she got very excited. She said, yeah, we could use this to create peace in the Middle East. And I said, well, absolutely right. And she said, well, actually, in the meantime, I've decided you need to use this to create peace in the whole world. But Middle East would be a good start, you know.
Well, what's really interesting, because of your book and so on and other things that I know, is that when you do work on yourself, and I always see everybody as like spiraling lights, right? As we do work on ourselves, that spirals through. I'm using it metaphorically. I'm not saying scientifically, but it does spiral through all the people. And when you were writing, part of the book was talking about basically detaching from the urgencies or the pain. I can't remember all the terms you used, but you just talked about the pain experience. It's that detaching that allows that flow to move from us to others, doesn't it? I mean, that.
Yeah, there are a couple of things. Yeah, I mean, when I learned basic mindfulness, ostensibly by accident, one of the first things that happened was my mum calmed down. So I could see that, you know, so I settled down and became less stressed. And my mum lives 100 miles away, but she settled down as well.
That's a brilliant story right there.
Yeah, I mean, that was a very simple thing which I noticed. But the other one, this exercise I mentioned, this whole thing, you can call them incompletions or pain patterns or samskaras or whatever you want to call them. So samskara is the Sanskrit word. Mm-hmm. So in the power of letting go, you probably saw there's an exercise, which is where you relive the incident and you release all the pain. And so what a lot of us
is that psychology?
No, it's not. No. So
I'm razzing you.
Yeah, thank you. No, so when, you know, when I did my Freudian psychoanalysis, you know, lie on the couch stuff when I had depression, you know, you kind of identify all these painful, horrible things that happen and you kind of lay them all out. Mm-hmm. But then there wasn't, at least at that time, wasn't a technique for dealing with them. So not to put it too crudely, it's a bit like analyzing it instead of flushing it away, right? Mm-hmm. So you analyze it, but nothing happens. So you probably know in Britain, we are world champions. British men are world champions at suppression. So, you know, something bad happens and we either suppress it and don't talk about it or we make a joke about it. But either way, we don't face it. This is, you know, which is where a lot of things like Monty Python and all these things come from. Mm-hmm. Mr. Bean, you know. So the way I do it now, and this is what happened a month ago, is it's called relive to relieve. So essentially, and this is the opposite of what many psychologists and psychiatrists will tell you. By the way, don't do this. You shouldn't do this if you're mentally ill. Okay. But you know, if you're otherwise healthy, this is a healthy thing to do. And I often help friends to do this. Is identify. Well, maybe we can do it now. You don't have to tell me what the event was, but can you recall the most emotionally painful thing that ever happened to you in your early childhood?
Yes.
Okay, and how old were you?
Probably four.
Four, okay. It's normally between 2 and 7. Mm-hmm. Okay, so 4, all right. And can you feel it in your body, this pain?
Yep.
Okay, where is it?
Belly area, just below the navel.
Okay, all right. So basically, we all have this. Unless you're enlightened, everybody's got this, right? So essentially, that pain has been there. I don't know how old you are, but it's been there for some time. and it's running your life. Mm-hmm. And so the way to get rid of it is, I don't even need to know what the incident is you go back and you become four. You just sit down with a cup of tea, close your eyes, and it's not remember, it's relive. So you become 4 years old with the way you saw life when you were four. Mm-hmm. And your understanding of the world when you were four, and you close your eyes and you just relive the incident. And relive it as many times as you want and just allow the emotions to come out. So some people laugh or cry, or it's like squeezing pus out of a wound. Mm. Some of these things, some of them have taken me many sittings, but essentially, if you keep
doing
that.
Thank you for saying that, because I think it'll take a while for me.
Yeah, I mean, there are variations. One is just to close your eyes and just relive it quietly on your own. You can also relive it by looking in a mirror. Mm-hmm. You can write it down. You can write it down and describe it to your guru out loud. There are many ways of doing it. But essentially what happens, the way I would describe it is, it becomes, when it has that emotional charge, then it's painful and it gets triggered. I don't know if you use social media, but if you could go on somewhere like Facebook, it's like hundreds of people being triggered all day long, right? Mm-hmm. By what other people say. And the whole thing we've had recently about Black Lives Matter and everything is like, or different parties in the debate getting triggered all over the place, right? Mm-hmm. And so what happens is, when we relive this pain in our early childhood, we can still recall the incident if we want to. So I can remember my first day at school, which is when mine started, but it doesn't have an emotional charge anymore. So it becomes a bit like a book in a library. Hmm. It's not running. I can remember it, but it's not running my life.
So you're saying you did it a number of times. You reconnected with that.
I did it a lot, yeah. Because it's what's called a root pattern. So in my case, you may have read that in the book. My first day at school, I turned up speaking like this. So this is, as you may know, this is the way southern middle class people speak in England, right? It's the English that BBC exports around the world. So I went, when I was four, we moved to Leicester, which is about an hour and a half north of London, and they have a different accent. Mm-hmm. And so when I went to school, people laughed at my accent and I felt like an outsider. And eventually dawned on me through doing this process 6 years ago with Swamiji. I formed this view that I was unacceptable. Mm-hmm. And once you see yourself as unacceptable at the age of five and go through your life seeing yourself as unacceptable, that creates chaos. You start projecting it onto others, you know, they become unacceptable to you and on we go. And so it was very valuable to identify that pain pattern, because once I'd completed it and, you know, relived it until it was the pain had diminished, it was a remarkable experience, because one day I was walking across the park to go to work and my mind was empty all of a sudden, like no thoughts. It was like I was like meditating my eyes open. And all I was doing was walking to the office. And that's how powerful this is. And that's when people do start experiencing pure consciousness effortlessly, because it's a bit like this pain is like something radioactive. And when you remove it, you know, that pain is generating thousands of thoughts, right? When you remove that pain, the thoughts go, they stop coming out.
Well, you know what I just noticed with mine, I won't get into very many detail at all, except I think as a counselor, I'm going, this is really interesting, because obviously I've worked myself, you know, a lot of times. But what I noticed is it keeps me holding back. The pain that I was working with under your tutelage there, it keeps me holding back. And I went, oh, boing. That's something I've been working on in myself. It's a feeling of holding myself back so nobody can get me.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and so I think you've really helped me already. I'm going, oh, good. Well, this is a good thing to know.
That's nice to hear. One thing I noticed after doing it, because you can complete, once you, it's a bit like a tree. If you complete with the root, it makes it much easier to deal with the tree. You know, all the...
Sure.
When I did this exercise thoroughly, I found 260 painful incidents.
Whoa.
Since the age. And then I went through and did completion on all of them. But one thing I noticed is as you remove them all is what comes is like huge love and creativity and spontaneity. And it's a bit like, you know, a dam breaking and just everything just flows.
A lot more self-love, right, I bet, eh?
Well, just love in general, you know. Yeah. And also, yes, you're not beating yourself up, partly because the self is kind of dissolving at that point. You just become... You know, in terms of the progression towards enlightenment, you know, you become, you're no longer this body mind worrying about what's going to happen.
I love that.
Because all those worries come from pain, right?
Mm-hmm. And it's a habitual thing. So do you believe we have you said the purpose is helping the planet and this kind of radiant activity.
I'm very keen on them helping to change the world. That can be. You know, investing a bit of money in a startup with some cure for some disease, that's still going to help change the world, you know, or cleaning up pollution. But a lot of it does come back to people's pain patterns, as far as I can see.
So talk for a minute about labels and so on, because something about our purpose, and I'm going, don't labels, I understand that labels confine us hugely.
Yeah.
But then about if you need to have a certain degree in order to get credibility to do something? I just want to be hyper simplistic about that. What do you do with all that?
Sometimes it's interesting. Sometimes it's not true that you need a degree.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's quite funny. The person who taught me executive search had a PhD in astrophysics from Cambridge, right? Mm-hmm. So he's quite educated. And I remember he used to say two things, like people would come to him, like more junior people, and say, oh, I've got so-and-so, so-and-so, so-and-so. They've all got degrees in X, Y, and Z. Say, William Shakespeare didn't have a degree. You know, or someone said, you know, he or she is too young to be chief executive. And he'd say, Alexander the Great died at 33.
Ooh, did he? Wow. That's a really good response, isn't it?
Yeah, so some of this stuff, and I know in the US, I mean, I was so fortunate because I went all through state school and then went to Cambridge, and it was almost free. And then when I went to do my banking training in Chicago, I met all these Americans who'd spent, you know, vast amounts of money, and I thought, wow. You know, so I know in the US there's this huge emphasis on education. There is in the UK as well, but I mean, sometimes it's not necessary, and sometimes it is necessary. But it can happen very naturally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I went to business school. I did my MBA in INSEAD in France, and I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
And it went extremely well. Then I got depression. But looking back, all my debts were paid off by the following Christmas. So I had scholarships and loans. But basically, as far as I can see, the cosmos wanted me to get that MBA done and out of the way. Yeah, so basically I won first prize at business school and then got clinical depression and all my debts were paid off.
What do you think the depression came from ignoring who you really were or a deeper?
We can all go back and, you know, reanalyze our past. But the way I look at it now, it was actually a blessing, because, you know, when we're small children, we're very well, most of us are spontaneous, right?
And, mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And then we go through this education system. And in my case, I was super keen on languages and economics and to some extent maths and things, math as you call it. Anyway, and then I became more and more analytical. And then I thought, well, I looked at investment banking and management consulting. I thought, well, I don't want to do that because the lifestyle's terrible. I mean, it seemed like very intelligent people working in a very unintelligent way.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I'd much rather work in executive search or be a fund manager, maybe. You know? And then I realized, oh dear, being in executive search or being a fund manager requires really strong intuition. And unfortunately, my intuition had stopped functioning.
because of a hyper-intellectual pursuits?
Yeah. You can become, you know, the Latin root of analysis, the word analysis, is to cut up into small pieces. So you can become very, very good at cutting up the world into small pieces. And then what I found was my intuition no longer functioned. I just didn't have a feel for people or a feel for what was going on. And so when I learned mindfulness, you know, apparently by accident, my intuition suddenly switched on, and suddenly I could read myself and I could read other people. And since then, it's developed much, much more.
So would you say that our intuition is fueled by being present?
I think being present is an aspect. I'm just thinking, I think it would be hard to be intuitive if you weren't present. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be, because like when we're present, we're not filled with thoughts about the past and the future. We're just here, you know, witnessing what's happening now. So I think being present maybe is like almost like a symptom of intuition. But I think intuition is, my favorite definition of intuition is immediate insight without reasoning. So you don't need to go through a thought process. I mean, as I understand it, great physicists like Einstein, you know, they get the answer intuitively and then they do the mathematics afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
It just comes to them as an insight, and then they figure out later how to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that, you know, when I'm recruiting people, is my intuition tells me something about this person. And then later on, I figure out why, which is a much slower process. But the intuition kind of tells you straight away, right?
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable, isn't it? It's a remarkable job there. So when you're, for example, with labels, I'm looking at my little lists of responses here. Okay. When you're looking at labels, don't you think, because what I really liked about that section of the book was that, don't we think that when I'm reaching for or stretching to be under labels, like a good mathematician or a good financial advisor or something, in a way we writhe under those labels, don't we?
So writhe?
Writhe, meaning we're trying to keep ourselves. Wriggle. Yeah, you know what I mean. We're trying to be this way always and make sure that look that way and we're credible that way.
Yeah, it's very limiting. I mean, I try not to label myself or other people. I mean, we need labels at some level, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But they're incredibly
for marketing.
I mean, they work. You might say, well, we're going to market this book to Spanish speakers. Well, it might be helpful if it were in Spanish. You know? I feel that's a label. but often labels are, I mean, I try to use labels as little as possible, because
sparingly.
because if you look at the universe, it's not really, labels are a kind of mental. I mean, even for example, you know, I was thinking about it yesterday, you know, the European Union or the United States, these are mental constructs, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can't, if you said, let's go out and look for the United States or look for European Union, they aren't there.
Mm-hmm.
They're just mental constructs, right? But we believe in them so strongly.
That when we have a global shutdown, it's unfathomable to think that there's a billion people in India shut down. Unfathomable to think of clumps of humanity in we define this way and that. Is that what you're saying, Charlie?
Yeah. And what's interesting is it's such a powerful label or mental construct. We all believe in it. Mm-hmm. And it actually stops us. People won't go beyond a certain one piece of ground to another piece of ground because of a mental construct that we've all agreed on, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you go to the border between, I don't know, the US and Canada, you have to presumably show paperwork or something because you're going from one piece of grass to the next piece of grass.
Yeah, and I'm Canadian, but I can't go home right now because, you know.
Yeah, okay, right, I didn't know that.
So, I might be bringing the plague.
Yeah, you could be, you could be. But, you know, so we've invented this mental construct and we've all bought into it to such a degree that you can't go home.
Isn't it remarkable? Think about it.
It's amazing, isn't it? You know, we created that. It's amazing.
And let's
take it very.
I'm going to jump around because I have to. There's such interesting facets of our existence that you've got itemized here. So I wanted to think about the conspiracy theories for a minute. Conspiracy theories are and talking about countries and global and black white and all of that. Talk a little bit about conspiracy theories and what they do for us or against us.
Well, I suppose, I mean, they can be true, right? I mean, you could have a conspiracy theory that turns out to be true.
Mm-hmm. Like a suspicion or something, yeah.
Yeah, you might have. Yeah, I mean, if it's a proper theory, you might have a theory that A is causing B.
Mm-hmm.
And you might do some investigation and find out that it's true. So I think having a theory is perfectly valid. And I'm a person, I'm not in favor of, you know, it happens a lot. At the moment is certain theories are not socially acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you might have a theory that that group is more intelligent than that group, but that becomes socially acceptable, so we can't talk about it. Well, if you want to be scientific, you could actually do some measurements. And, of course, there are many ways of measuring intelligence, but you could test whether that theory was correct or not, right, if you're going to be scientific about it. But I think what happens with conspiracy theories is people do the opposite. They have a theory, that's fine. And instead of... So there's a lady mentioned in the book called Susanna Sullstrom Matthews, who used to teach economics in Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, she's very clear about it. She said, well, if you have a theory, what you should do is go out and look for evidence that contradicts your theory. And then if it, cause, you know, to try and destroy your theory, to refute your theory.
Mm-hmm.
But what many people do is they have a theory like, you know, the world is run by a small group of evil people who live on top of a mountain or something.
Mm-hmm.
They'll have that theory, and instead of looking for evidence to the contrary, they will go running around and only consider evidence that confirms that, right? And then you get these ludicrous conversations. I mean, that's a conspiracy theory, and it's very limiting, and it will probably, you're misleading yourself massively if you do that.
And that's where you talk about your bubble. That puts you in your own bubble, doesn't it?
Well, that's what's happened on social media. Yeah, so, you know, when social media got going, I suppose people idealistically thought it was going to bring us all together, and it hasn't. It's put us in separate filter bubbles. I don't know if everyone listening knows this, but Facebook, for example, continuously optimizes so that you only see information that you agree with and things that you like. and also you tend to unfriend people who disagree with you. So after some period of time, you only get information that fits your worldview. And then something surprising happens, like, you know, Britain leaves the European Union or the country votes for Donald Trump. And then you're totally shocked because you don't know anybody who would agree with that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, isn't that
because
something? Hey?
You've excluded them all from your bubble. You know, I mean, when we voted 4 years ago to leave the European Union, a friend of mine wrote on Facebook, how can this have happened? I don't know anyone that voted that way.
And she,
because basically they'd all left her bubble, you know, or she'd excluded them.
I think that's really fascinating because what you're saying is in that confinement, our life becomes kind of predictable. And also, I mean, if we know what people's bubbles are, life becomes predictable and there's this amazing possibility that gets shut down.
Yeah, that happens. And also we can be completely deluded. Like we can have some view of the world, which is completely wrong.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is I personally feel the media conspires.
I do too. Thank you. Talk
they conspire
about
not to give us information. Here's an example, right? Do you know what the population of Scotland is?
I do not, no.
Okay. Do you know what the population of England is?
No.
Okay. Do you have any idea? Let's not worry about how big they are. Do you have any idea how big the population of England is compared to the population of Scotland?
Hmm. I want to say, no, I want to say England has more, but I get this intuitive hit that Scotland's probably more.
No, England has 11 times as many people as Scotland.
Really?
Yeah, it's 50. So England's about 55 million. Scotland's about 5 million.
Well, here's something funny as an intuitive.
I'll never tell you that.
Yeah, I think it's really funny because as an intuitive, I saw Scotland as being in a funny way more hunkered down and powerful. And I go, that must be something to do with their attitude.
Well, they've produced some amazing people. The thing is, a lot of them leave the country. I mean, they've produced amazing scientists. Well, you know, there are loads of them in the US and in London. And they produce some great people, many of whom have emigrated. But the reason I mention that as an example is the BBC, for example, will never, I've never ever heard them talk about the, you know, they always give, quite rightly, they talk about Scotland and they give press coverage, but they will never tell you the relative population sizes. And you see, I see similar things happening with the whole debate about diversity, and a lot of the media will never tell you the numbers. In fact, in Britain, they've only just started, I don't know if you know, but Britain is much less ethnically diverse than the US, right? The only reason...
Oh, it is? I thought it was really mixed with a lot of Asians.
No, it's not. The BBC has always... If you watch the BBC, because BBC is very London-centric, you get the impression that, you know, half of the UK is ethnic minorities.
Right.
It's not. It's about 15%.
Oh, really?
And black people, and the only reason this has come out is because
George
of coronavirus.
Floyd. Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm. No, not that. No, it's not that. No, that's, you know, that's provoked a lot of debate. And what's interesting is during that debate, the BBC does not tell you how many people in Britain are black, which is about 3%, right? I think in the US it's about 13-14%. It's a lot more.
Yeah, I think so.
But what's interesting is the BBC, the only reason they ever started talking about what percentage of Britain was ethnic minorities was because ethnic minorities, the mortality rate with COVID-19 is much higher with ethnic minorities in the UK, including medical doctors.
America as well.
Yeah, and they were saying, and all of a sudden they said, why is this? And they said, oh, by the way, you know, this group represent, let's say, 13, 14, 15% of the population, but they represent 35 to 40% of all the deaths. And that was the first time the BBC had actually said, by the way, ethnic minorities are, you know, 15% of the population. If you turn on the television, you know, you'd think it was way more like the US. It's not.
Hmm.
You know, and so I think the media, often the bias in the media is the information they don't give you.
I agree. I was in radio. I was paid to be in radio just for a short period of time. But I said, and it was way back, and it was talk radio in the U.S., and I said to my boss, who was really quite a brilliant man, actually, I said, hey, look at what's coming in on the AP news feed. And I'm from Canada, right? So I'm looking at this saying, wow, that's a really interesting story. He goes, no, you don't understand. He said, America has a pride in its right to be ignorant. And you're from Canada. You don't understand. We don't put that kind of news up. And that was probably 30 years ago. And I went, I was really hurt in my idealistic heart, you know. But so what you're saying, I had a little bit of proof for, although I'm not in it anymore, you know. But let's talk about how to break out of the jail, the confinement we have. Like, for example, racism is a huge confinement that's gone on probably since time began. But it's horrendous.
Oh, massive.
It is horrendous. You know that, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And what do you think happens with letting go and something like racism?
That's a very good question. I mean, maybe I should write something about this. I mean,
I think it would be a wonderful healer for a lot of us. Yeah.
Yeah, I think I should maybe do that. The first time I went to India, which is, I've been there five times. First time I went, a long time ago, I remember, it was later. It was the second time I went, which was 6 years ago. I met a monk on the ashram, which belongs to Swamiji. And this monk said, identity always leads to violence.
Oh.
And that kind of sank into my brain. And the way I see it is, and is if you come from a particular group, whatever it is, where the if you what essentially happens is you know we all have a particular skin color, we all have a particular background, we all have pain which we've inherited from our parents or our ancestors. You know, everybody's got it, and in many different variations, right? And some a bit more acutely than others. So, you know, I have quite a lot of black friends, I have quite a lot of Indian friends, I have lots of Jewish friends, and you know, some of this stuff goes back centuries, right?
But I laugh at going in, you've got Catholic friends, and you've got, I mean, it's different. Oh, yeah, but yeah. It isn't really, it's got a whole container there.
Yeah. So everybody's got guilt or pain or suffering or whatever it is, going back a long way.
Sure.
And so the problem is, if you identify with that and they say, that is me, you know, like, for example, I'm British, or I'm a Cambridge graduate, or I'm white, or I'm whatever. As soon as you start doing that,
even saying in this crazy country, I'm Canadian, sounds like you're a little bit more safe or calmer, nicer.
Is it? That's like a civilized version. What's it called? It's called an American with health insurance or something.
Yeah.
And no guns.
No guns, yeah. And peaceful. Yeah. And when I was going to do a radio thing, that my helper, who you know as well, Melinda, said to me, now when you get up to speak, don't be Canadian, which is typical for people who are too nice, too gentle, and not really.
Oh, I see, yes.
So yeah. And so it's just another label. I just thought I'd throw it in for fun. It's like it's like racism. Well,
I mean sometimes it's kind of fun, but the thing is, if we really identify strongly, it does lead to violence, and that violence may just be internal. It brings up all that suffering, and
comparison.
The solution is, it creates all kinds of problems. And the way I see it is, if you do the completion exercise that we were just talking about, if you relive the pain and get rid of it, then that identity, because it's basically ego. Ego isn't just about feeling better than everybody else. Ego can be about feeling worse than everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
It's still separating you from existence and making life painful. And I mean, recently, this may sound mad, but so I did the completion exercise with the 260 painful incidents.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of it, we did a ritual. I've done this a couple of times. I never understood these rituals they have in India called a Homa. Have you come across this?
Yes.
You have come across it.
We're going to do full moon rituals. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's it. This was on Guru Purnima. So it's the, we did it, what was it? Last weekend, that was it. But what was amazing was I kind of fell asleep. I was so tired because it started at 2 a.m. our time. But I kind of fell asleep or fell into meditation. And it was a bit like one of those movies. I kind of woke up as though I'd landed somewhere. And I kind of couldn't remember most of my pain.
Oh,
it was weird.
Interesting.
So we did this exercise over about 10 days, like really intensely, several hours a day, you know, reliving it in the mirror, writing it down, talking to Swamiji about it. We did all this stuff. And then right at the end, there was a Homa. And the mark of a really good completion is struggling to remember what happened. What was it I was so wound up about? And sometimes you can't find it.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That's me. It's really has worked, right?
Yeah, because I often say, you know, our bodies are like file folders, and we store this, that, and the other in there. And you're saying that whole file went.
Or you can empty out the file, and all you've got is like the cardboard thing. There's nothing in it. Yeah. You don't actually remember what was in it. Yeah.
I don't want to miss this part on purpose. You also talked about oneness, and I love that. And you had that great story. I don't know if you want to reiterate it right now. You might want to. On the train, but I just want to tell you right now.
Oh my goodness! Yes.
Right now,
this in America.
I'm staring at this beautiful three big, huge trees in front of our window here.
Yeah, yeah.
And what happens is the eagles very often land and take off. So if I'm doing relationship counseling or whatever, they'll often fly together, fly apart, go here and there, as if they're in sync. And I thought of that when I was reading your oneness story.
Yeah.
So please. Talk that one. I like that.
Oh, well, oneness is an amazing thing. So the basic principle is that, so when I had clinical depression, that's the opposite of oneness. That's like massive ego separation. no connection with anybody, no helpful coincidences, nothing, right?
Okay.
And then what happens is the more you remove the pain from your system, and the more you meditate, for example, the more you start to experience oneness. And what I give it, so there's an example in the book, which is after I learned transcendental meditation, I was on a train in London, and I could see that a young man was about to start beating up an older man. And I definitely recommend people don't do this at home, least of all in the US. But basically, I was standing there reading the news, and all of a sudden, several of us were lying on top of the younger man, so he couldn't move. We were just lying on top of him. And I was nearest, and I just spoke into his ear, and I said, don't do anything to this man, you'll go to jail. And then we all, and this is like Britain, you know, no one talked. And then we all jumped off him again, and at the next stop, he just swore and got off the train.
Wow.
And it was a bit like, you know, when you see fish, shoals of fish or flocks of birds. It was like we were all flying in sync. We didn't talk. It's very strange.
I think that's a brilliant story. It's like...
I mean, it's an unusual thing. The other thing I'd just like to mention briefly, because I think this is a recent example of oneness, which I think will help your listeners, is I've been recently working in a company, and my colleagues were getting quite stressed about the chief executive, about his behavior. And they did the usual thing. They were trying to, you know, like, how do we deal with him? How do we change his behavior? What can we do? You know, which is a normal thing, right? Mm-hmm. How can I intervene and sort out this problem? And what I did was I said, okay, so he's triggering some pain in me, right? So I went back over my life and found the earliest time in my life when I had felt that way. And I relived that incident thoroughly and released the pain. And what was interesting was within 24 hours, his behavior had changed. I didn't say a word to him.
Wow.
And that's, you know, it's an example of oneness is, you know, he and I are one. Mm-hmm. So if I clean up my mess, he'll change anyway.
And your mess is often a hidden pain or reaction that's been.
Yeah, so he's true. So basically, you know, it's a bit like people, psychologists talk about projection is I feel pain because of his behavior. Mm-hmm. So if I turn inwards and release my pain using the completion technique, he'll either go away or his behavior would change, one or the other. But either way, the problem will disappear.
I love that. So when we were talking about the bubble, it's a similar thing. If people really identified their own bubble, would you say that? Can you talk a bit about that before we have to say goodbye?
Yeah, I think the bubble, it's not exactly the same thing, but the bubble, I suppose what happens with the bubble is it's related to the ego because you're just kind of assembling a group of people who are just like you. Mm-hmm. And when, as we move towards enlightenment, we feel oneness with everyone and everything, right? And so that bubble will disappear.
I think I focused on that just because there's so much election conversation going on here and so much racism going on here in all kinds of places. And I'm going, well, we kind of like to hang out in our bubbles where we're safe from conjecture or whatever. But the way you were talking, I'm going, if we release that and release our own pain, then we emanate or we become a part of that which changes, not just for one person, but many, right?
Everybody. Yeah,
no, that's really interesting. That's what I really love about this book is that things are written in such a way, to me, they should be easy so we don't spend time intellectualizing them, to be them, you know?
I think it's much, much preferred to experience things and then maybe sometimes I understand afterwards how it worked, but I prefer not to analyze everything before I do it. I just like to do it and see what happens.
Well, that sure makes sense to me. So you're over in England and you're also you're still doing the work you're doing about finding people that fit into different companies.
Yeah, so I still recruit people, but they've kind of I'm working on the sequel to The Power of Letting Go, and it's aimed at leaders.
Okay.
So I recruit leaders, but also I talk to leaders in politics. The theory is, you know, if we help leaders to change, then the whole world will change.
We have some people in mind for you down here. I'm sure you have your own ideas on all that. And I won't get into politics right now. But I think actually it's so important for you want to change the world. And my heart wants to as well. That it's so important to help people see what they're doing and how it confines them as opposed to liberates them, you know.
Yeah, I agree.
So you've done a great job. So when do you think the sequel will come out, next year?
Oh, well, it's, I don't know. I mean, I've got about 20, sorry, I've got about 20% of the normal number of words.
Okay.
Oh, just one thing I noticed, which was a big surprise. I've done, this is the first podcast I've done in the US.
Okay.
The thing that's selling best in The Power of Letting Go is audiobooks in the US, and I've done no promotion in the US. So I'm even thinking about releasing this book on audiobook.
I think that's a brilliant idea.
Yeah.
I'll tell you why, because we're so conversation-centric these days, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I get out of my car, and the first thing I do is get a lecture on my you know, choose a lecture that can come through my radio system and so on. It'd be a great place to be paying attention to what you're doing. And
that might work. It's not, but no closed eye meditations, right?
No, it's preferred not to. Well, I really have enjoyed this. I could probably pick your brains for another ton of time, but maybe we'll talk over your next book.
That would be wonderful. And thank you very much for inviting me, Veronica.
Well, thank you for coming on. This is John Perkis. And people know how to get hold of you, or do they?
Yes. Well, it's very simple. It's johnperkis.com. So johnperkis.com.
Nice
and
to
all
have
the links on there.
Nice to have KISS in your name. There's a lot about unconditional love in that, isn't there?
Yeah, it used to be a problem, but you know, I think spam filters have become more sophisticated now.
Well, thank you again, John, and thank you for being a paradigm shifter. We're making a big difference here. Take care.
Kind of you. All right.
Many
have
blessings.
A good day. See you.
Yeah, you too. Bye.